Welcome to the Asia edition of Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech podcast. I'm Rachel Williamson.
And I'm Karis Palmer. Every fortnight, we dissect the successes and failures of financial innovators and bring you the people at the top of their field working to disrupt banking.
From traditional banks doing things differently to startups navigating the unforgiving world of financial services, I'm Simon Spencer, and this is Breaking Banks Asia.
To break the grip of corruption and black money, we have decided that the 500 rupee and 1,000 rupee currency notes presently in use will no longer be legal tender from midnight tonight.
Welcome to Breaking Banks Asia. I'm your host, Karis Palmer, and in this second part of our series on cash cards and digital wallets, we shift our focus to the challenges and opportunities of an entirely digital payments world and look to the innovation happening beyond consumer payments. We'll start with the legacy of India's controversial 2016 demonetization program and investigate the future of cross-border payments where things are hotting up. Back for this episode and opening the show is Monica D'Souza, advisor to fintechs and ambassador for the Emerging Payments Association Asia. Monica had a front row seat to what happened after India's demonetization program. Many people are still debating whether it was a good move or not. But 8 years on, they're starting to understand its impact on digital payments.
When demonetization happened, the rise of digital payments and a massive explosion happened because users did not have any other option. And when they didn't have any other option, this became the easiest method for adoption to be created and therefore be galvanized against a crisis situation where users needed money in order to be able to have services.
Monica, let's get into what else has happened since Indian PM Narendra Modi made that arbitrary decision to remove large bills from circulation.
So I will talk about the two significant impacts that have happened. Number one, the tax-paying population, at least in India, has actually gone up. This also is significantly being contributed by the demographic dividend, which is these very, very young consumers who have started earning money and therefore are contributing to the growth of income tax. However, the tax-paying population is still only 2% of all of India's population. 2-5%. The reason I say this is because there is a lot of people who file taxes but file zero taxes. So there's a very interesting, at least inference that I have with regards to this. I think demonetization helped a lot of players who were in the market then, had the first mover, second mover advantage to be relevant at a time when India needed these services. And second, once users realized that cash could not be used, they took to these services.
But Monica says there's a big missing element before digitization can really take hold.
So we need merchants to be more comfortable to show their income and to pay taxes. These are the MSMEs who are typically the lifeline of every single country, which is not very digitized. Whether you look at Asia, you look at Africa, all these merchants are the ones who typically will rely on payments to come in for them to pay their suppliers and for the suppliers to give them the goods that they can put on stores. So if we need this chain now to be disrupted and become cashless, we need the supply chain to also become digitized, which has been a very big missing element. Whenever you talk to any of the MSMEs and you say, how is your cash coming in? They say, we don't like cash either. But when you tell them that, you know, this money is going to the bank account, suddenly they say, you know, I wish I could pay for what I'm buying and putting on the store also in cashless methods, because I still need to go to the bank, withdraw from my ATM, and then pay the supplier. And this becomes an extra overhead for them in addition to all the services that they are providing. And it takes away both time and capital effort.
So while India's highly successful universal payments interface means it now accounts for 46% of all digital payments in the world, India still has work to do to close the loop on digital. While many people assume smartphone users in Asia are digitally savvy, Monica says it's more complicated than that, and digital payment providers still have work to do to garner the trust of consumers.
There's a very large part of the population that is digitally illiterate. So smartphone adoption might have increased in a lot of our countries. In fact, India leads the race now. It's the number two country in smartphone usage. But the question really becomes, do you own a smartphone and therefore are you financially literate and digitally literate to be able to adopt digital payments? The answer is a big no. So what do people use their phones for? It's not for payments. It's not for everyday activity. It's not even for learning, which means that we need to spend a lot of time and money on digital education, which is how do you make your access to financial services secure? How do you protect yourself? And with cyber crimes and especially AI related frauds increasing, I think the trust in digital payments gets displaced. And once you have had a fraud issue, typically a person will never come back because cash is looked at as a reliant way of being able to exchange money for services.
Shares of 197 Communications, parent of fintech giant Paytm, have slumped 40% in 2 days, erasing over $2 billion in market value. The losses came on the back of the RBI ticket that ordered its subsidiary, Paytm Payments Bank, to halt nearly all banking transactions.
That's the Indian media reporting on the challenges facing Paytm, one of India's most popular digital wallet fintechs. Its banking partner was reprimanded for reportedly failing to properly identify customers, leaving accounts open to money laundering. Paytm has since gone on to find new banking partners so it can live on. While regulators remain busy with the fraud, cybercrime, and data breaches that plague online payments, they face a new headache in a world where all payments are becoming digitized, and that's reliability. In February this year, the UPI system faced some big outages, with customers of some banks unable to make any payments at all. So Monica, what do you think needs to be done to prevent this sort of situation happening again?
Payments happens to be a complete lifeline for a country like India. India has more payments than all of the United States in like a couple of years. And that happens in a month. Now, that is really scary because we have to protect and consider our infrastructure to be a national security related risk. And it begs the question whether we should have contingency measures in place and whether a robust infrastructure requirement is something that the governments and the regulators need to institute. I think very hard questions need to be asked of providers. When we place trust in them to be able to carry out services and for toward 99.59's efficiency and performance levels, where is the accountability, including penalties, if services go down? They are also able to question the people who govern us, and we are able to throw them out by electoral means in most countries. How do we hold these companies, especially big techs and the huge tech firms, accountable?
Singapore's regulator has been leading the way in this regard. Some 93% of Singapore's population use digital payments, and it's growing. This means its regulator, the Monetary Authority, has had to sharpen its claws when dealing with preventable payment system failures. Recently, when an overheating data center caused a bank services outage of more than the allowed 4 hours per year at leading bank DBS, the regulator stopped the bank from doing any acquisitions, non-compliance-related IT upgrades, or removal of ATMs for 6 months. I spoke to Anthony Thomas, Citibank veteran, fintech expert, and non-executive chairman at Vietnamese digital wallet Momo, about these types of outages and whether they're the reason people are sticking with cash. You'll remember Anthony from the first part of this two-part show.
I don't see the end of cash. And the larger reason for this is probably not the outages. I feel that the more structural reason is probably the costs of accepting cash are still perceived to be high for merchants, whether it be the MDR, the merchant discount rate. And the irony is that the payments business is one of the lowest margin businesses. Simply in some markets, it could mean being caught in the tax net. And in some cases, it's the friction of opening accounts for a merchant or a consumer, which is still high.
But you still have that fear of the system going down and completely losing access to your money, which is not a fear if you have a lot of cash in your wallet, even though we saw during COVID that access to cash can also be limited in times of crisis. So Anthony, how big of an issue is that fear and that lack of confidence in a digital money system?
In some cases, as you pointed out, trust may be low and confidence is definitely lost with outages, I agree, or fear of security or data privacy or a fraudulent transaction, or even something as small as a failed transaction. All of this probably happens 0.01% of the time or less. But for that one customer, trust is lost, and that customer shares that experience with others, and collectively we're all set back. So this is something that we hopefully can work together to solve better. And I understand why regulators would come down hard, because a lot of the good work is destroyed in minutes, or of course in some of these cases hours. So again, in examining a cashless society, we would need to examine factors, you know, beyond the odd incident where we lose trust, but also structural condition.
One of the biggest structural changes looming on the horizon is that of central bank digital currencies. Regular listeners of the show will remember our recent chat with economist Richard Holden, who's pushing for a Fed coin in his new book, Money in the 21st Century. Richard is predicting Australia will be functionally cashless by 2030, and he also says markets that opt for a CBDC will likely remove cash from the equation before going down that path.
I think if you create a CBDC, you're going to get rid of physical cash. I mean, that would be the point of doing it. I don't think having them run alongside each other in the medium term makes a whole lot of sense. And look, cash is, in one sense, I know why people say, well, it seems cheap because I don't, you know, see any transaction fees when I pay with cash, but they are paying for it. It's actually the, you know, one of the most expensive parts of the system. There's the creation and distribution of cash. There's all the, you know, keeping cash on hand and all that sort of stuff. You know, there are still ATMs still get filled up by people who drive big armored vans and, you know, carry guns while they, you know, put that stuff in. That's in some cases quite dangerous work and certainly expensive work. So people are paying for that. They're just paying for it in roundabout ways through, you know, account keeping fees and things like that. So I think actually a central bank digital currency and the phasing out of cash should allow banking to be a lot cheaper. Basically are going to take quite a lot of cost out of the system.
So does that mean central banks could become the basic bank account providers of choice in the future? Richard says it's possible.
The model of a central bank digital currency that I outline in the book maintains a role for commercial banks. As I don't get rid of commercial banks, they'll still deal with customers, originate loans, you know, maintain those relationships. I think that's the best approach. But there is an alternative approach, and people have, you know, started thinking more about this after things like the Silicon Valley Bank collapse, which is that a central bank would basically just take over banking and there would be no need for commercial banks. And you would have, if you're in the US, you'd have an account at the Fed. Now it would be an account on your, you know, phone or computer or whatever. And in a country like Australia, you know, you'd have an account with the Reserve Bank of Australia and so on in other countries. That's not the preferred model, certainly not my preferred model, but it's certainly a very respectable viewpoint that some very serious people have suggested, you know, could work. So there is that route, and then the government really can make banking free for everyone.
I asked Anthony Thomas whether he could envisage a world where payment providers and wallets are able to remove traditional banks from the equation, particularly in markets where banks no longer wish to be a provider of basic bank accounts.
I actually don't see that happening anytime soon. Bank accounts are still probably the termination point for a lot of these transactions with wallets, right? Even though wallets can source funds in certain jurisdictions, not in Vietnam, but in certain jurisdictions outside of the banking system from, so let's say, cash-in points, which is the traditional wallet model. I still think the vast majority of funds that are flowing into wallets flow in from banks and flow out to banks because that's convenient, right?
So what is the wallet's relevance then? Where do you think they're going to fit into the broader market in the future?
High frequency, small ticket transactions is where I think the wallet is relevant in making life convenient, you know, day-to-day life. I think in terms of keeping larger balances, firstly, wallets are in many jurisdictions capped on, you know, the balance that can be held. And I don't think the purchase of a home or even paying rent is going to naturally happen on a wallet. So I think that's why banks aren't stepping away anytime soon. And I don't think wallets, as much as they have gained in popularity, are going to displace. In fact, I see more and more partnership because wallets in many instances are becoming financial services platforms. Again, the business model for a wallet is not well served by building a balance sheet, but value can be created in extending credit. And the way that value gets created is now you have a lot more data to underwrite a customer. You have an easy way to identify the purpose for which credit may be used. You have a way to disburse funds conveniently. You have a way to collect conveniently. So all of those are value components which wallets can serve the consumer and the bank on, get their fair share of value, and the bank has an efficient way to acquire customers, service customers, collect from customers, but still hold that relationship as well.
The real question, according to Monica D'Souza, is who will ultimately pay for the necessary payments infrastructure to support low-value payments?
Actually, I feel that the costs have to be borne for a certain period of time. At least India has shown the way. I think the regulators across the world are going to cap, and they've already started capping debit, credit in terms of MDR. But there is a bigger reason to be able to see this as, again, a national effort rather than looking at this as another means of payment. Now, I'm actually against zero MDR, which is my personal view, which is that nobody has to pay for payments because payments is a service. And maintaining infrastructures takes that amount of technology effort. It requires development and it requires a huge amount of maintenance effort. Cybersecurity being a risk requires that we spend millions, if not billions of dollars to keep consumers' interest above everything else and keep them safe. Payments has become very commoditized because of this capping, which has happened because of governments and regulators becoming very active.
But we know governments are often strapped for cash, and that's why those sorts of costs are being outsourced to the private sector with all the pros and cons that come from that. So who do you think will ultimately pay?
Merchants would not like to pay specifically if they are not able to see the reason why they should be paying. But I think we have to look at this more from an education angle and as more from the long term rather than the short term. In the short term, a merchant who is earning, say, $200 to $1,000 per month. When I'm saying earning, as in is able to see that level of volume happening at the store, may not be able to realize the difference that cash makes over digital or digital makes over cash in terms of increase of ticket size. This is where I feel that digitization has to be supported, at least, and it has to be phase-wise efforts to take users and therefore also merchants from across the maturity curve, where they are able to see the impact to their businesses. It's not going to be a couple of months. It will also not be a year or two. It is going to be over decades where we see this difference that merchants are going to see. Now, costs have to be borne by somebody. And if costs have to be borne by the taxpayer, then so be it, which is the case that is happening in India, where the UPI payments are free. But merchants do have to pay for it at a certain point in time. And most of these efforts are being borne by taxpayer money because they need to be subsidized for this larger population to take to digital payments. So this is one method which seems to have worked, but I don't know how sustainable it is. And somebody has to pay.
Brad Pragnell, payments policy expert who we spoke to in the first part of this series, agrees regulation can only go so far in shifting more consumers to digital payments, which after all, are a business.
I can remember a few years back, there was a lot of discussion around invisible payments. You know, that was the dream that payments would effectively disappear. But it's interesting now that we're able to do that. People are actually kind of turning away a little bit from that. When you make payments invisible, you lose certain things. You lose that point of contact, that ability to interact, loyalty, customer feedback, delighting the customer, all that sort of stuff. I think it ignores economics and the commercial reality of this. I think it's kind of a technologist's dream, but I think actually from a commercial point of view, payments is a business.
At the same time as governments are grappling with payment surcharge caps and subsidies, crypto and other digital asset markets continue to grow, often relatively unregulated. It's here that super low value transactions can take place without the type of infrastructure banks and cash providers have to carry. But there is a disconnect between the weeks or months long timelines that fintechs think in and the years long timelines that regulators operate in. Fintechs in decentralized finance can't and aren't waiting for regulators to catch up with them.
I do think that if you're going to wait for payments infrastructure to be introduced or for regulatory reform to solve your problems, it's a bit like waiting for Godot, right? You know, you have to go out, find the customers, delight them, deliver the services that they want and need and that they're prepared to pay for. That's been the secret to success in the past, and that'll continue to be the secret to success in the future.
Fintechs might not be waiting for regulators to catch up with them, but Monica says private innovation in digital assets is going to be hampered by regulation and the current demands of investors.
So digitization efforts, and specifically digital assets, is also being something which is being monitored by the government. So for example, in India, holding any kind of digital asset is subject to taxation, and it's at the highest slab. There have also been a lot of calls by regulators and by government officials to actually collaborate with other governments so that there is a certain amount of lack of anonymity. And therefore, their government knows exactly what kind of digital assets are being used, being created, being traded, and being exchanged. So as far as digital assets is concerned, I actually see that the innovation that we had seen again during the COVID and a little bit after, up till 2022, including NFTs and a lot of assets exchanging value in terms of being only digital, is actually moving away. So the euphoria may have died down, but I still see the Web3 world emerging.
So Monica, what is possible then? Where do you see the growth in digital assets now?
Under the regulatory scanner, there will be innovation that is possible because it simply takes away a lot of inefficiencies that still exist in the system that require operational handling and manual labor to be employed in order to be able to solve for those use cases. The problem is the uptake is going to be slow. And in our side of the world, with where innovation is concerned, because of a lot of VC and PE pressure, typically innovation has to reach the masses earlier.
Monica is far more upbeat on what could happen next on the government side, particularly with CBDCs and cross-border payments.
So digital assets is so far unexplored. I would think that from the private side, the innovation is going to be limited or is going to be regulated. But on the government side, CBDCs, for example, will offer a huge roadmap for use cases to be developed only for digital methods. And I think that is going to be an exciting space. What kind of use cases can be pushed to digital assets completely? And how will the governments cooperate with each other in order to be able to push a lot of the current exchange of values to be able to de-dollarize based on digital asset creation and exchange? And we are seeing regional efforts, which are cross-border efforts, happening in certain parts of the world outside of the main big economies, which is in Europe and United States. So we have the Asian corridor, we have the South Asia corridor, we have the BRICS countries. All of them are talking about de-dollarization, and that gets further accelerated when you start thinking about CBDCs and the absolute potential that digital assets will have, specifically if the governments start talking to each other, start agreeing on how asset exchange will happen. And then there will be an impact on the biggest currencies that are used for trade and other efforts, including defense payments. Now, that would be an exciting use of technology and digitization that we haven't seen before, but this is already happening as we are speaking.
Asia's central banks could be the ultimate drivers of digital replacing cash and cross-border payments becoming not only more seamless, but a means by which to shift global geopolitics. Or an agile corporation could master digital assets and regulatory arbitrage in a way that completely changes the landscape for everyone. We're certainly looking forward to watching this space. I'm your host, Karis Palmer, and you've been listening to Breaking Banks Asia.
If you enjoyed today's episode of Breaking Banks Asia, don't forget to share it on Twitter, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you listen to our show. This helps us build our audience and support our sponsors so we can continue to bring you a great show every fortnight.